the scramble out of Haiti. Daring missions, official charters.
You obviously saw tears, you saw laughter, you saw joy.
Hundreds making it out, hundreds more who need help. The crisis in Haiti putting border law back in state headlines.
When a special legislative session to give our law enforcement more authority to arrest and detain.
Help or more hurt? Florida just outlawed living on the streets.
We will never, ever, ever support arresting our way out of homelessness.
South Florida costs, consequences, and a quest to end homelessness. And eyes to the sky.
Truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Solar suspense and the science of a lifetime. What you don't know about the coming total eclipse of the sun. Breaking the big news of the week, all live this week in South Florida.
Good Sunday morning to you. Thanks for being here. I'm Glenna Milberg. As we come on the air, the scramble is underway to get Floridians, Americans, and those in need out of an increasing danger in Haiti. The State Department has done two flights this week. Private operators have swooped in on their own. Our focus today is on the state's efforts. Literally now underway, a flight landing this morning with 21 people aboard. Earlier this week, a first rescue flight from the state with 14 people on board landed in Sanford. More are in the works, hamstrung though by the bureaucracy of several countries and security concerns, etc. Hundreds have signed up on a new state portal with information about those needing rescue. The man in the eye of this logistics storm is Kevin Guthrie. He is Florida's Director of Emergency Management, and he is with us this morning live. Director Guthrie, endlessly grateful for your time. I know it is a really busy time. You are always in the eye of some kind of storm. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Glenna. Thank you for having us. And yeah, we've got about 8 executive orders right now, still going all the way back to Hurricane Ian that we're working. But, you know, right now, this is our primary focus to get Floridians home.
So let's break a little news this morning. There is a flight that landed just a little while ago with 21 people on board. Where did that land? Who's on board? And how did that get done?
Yeah, Glenna, so yesterday, late into the early evening, I would call it 7:30 p.m., just before sunset down in Haiti, we were able to get a flight of, 21 people heading to this, heading here to Orlando International Airport. We have consciously moved our operations from Sanford over to MCO Orlando International because CBP is here until midnight. So it gives us a lot more opportunity, but we did get 21 on the ground about 12:15 this morning. We got them to a hotel and now we're moving them to their final destination. Most of them living in the Southeast Florida area that is obviously your viewing area.
Yeah. Okay. So I looked up that flight, the tail number of that flight, and it looks like that flight is actually right now back in Cap Haitien. Is that another rescue flight today in the works?
Yes, ma'am. We are working right now. We have two planes on the ground, one staged in the Turks and Caicos. Our goal every day is to fly people out. So the way that the government is working right now is working inside of Haiti is we're getting daily permits. So we can't get anything to land every day for a week or every day for the next 2 weeks. We have to do this bureaucratic process every single day. So what happens is we start filing our paperwork early in the morning. Usually by about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, we hear something back that says we are cleared to fly. And then we try to rush around because this particular airport does not have runway lights. So we have to be off the ground by sunset so that we can do what they call visual flight rated type maneuvers. So we are working through that. We work through that every day. We start working the issues about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And then move people. Again, we don't know if we're going to have an aircraft or not, so we have to move people backwards and forwards inside of Haiti. But right now, today, we're planning on running two flights, somewhere around 50 people. That may end up being less. It may end up being, you know, we have a third flight on standby. Maybe we can get up to 80 or 100 out today, but we're going to keep working that. I don't go into a whole lot of the tactics, but we do have to strategically and tactically move inside of Port-au-Prince to get people to safety. That is a very, very tenuous operation, roadblocks, gunfire, things of that nature. So we're working diligently to get everybody out. But right now, we believe we're going to be able to run at least 30 today, maybe a little bit more than that.
So to your point, without giving too much of the strategy away, I just want to clarify, you're in Port-au-Prince, where really most of the danger is, because I know at least federally the State Department is telling people they need to be rescued from Cap Haitien, but don't go if you can't get there securely and safely. So if your people are in Port-au-Prince, are you driving people to the airport 100 miles away?
Yeah, again, we're utilizing a various methodologies of getting people out of Port-au-Prince. We are, you know, that could be by land, air, or sea. A combination of all three, if you will. And you've seen the helicopters landing from the State Department. We have a similar tactic where we go in and we will land at a designated spot. To the best of our ability, try to secure that spot and make sure that there's no activity around. Then call somebody in and then literally just come in and swoop up and get those individuals on a helicopter. That's one particular way that we do it. And that's very, very similar to what you've seen over and over again on State Department videos. That's a similar tactic we use there, but we are using some other tactics as well. We did shift a little bit yesterday, which allowed us to get the largest flight out that we've done so far. So we'll continue to head in that direction and hopefully have more success here in the coming days.
Are you having an okay time coordinating with anyone on the ground there or maybe the surrounding governments, Dominican Republicans, Turks and Caicos? Is there any kind of coordination that and cooperation that you've been finding or is it really an obstacle, the official on the ground?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The Turks and Caicos is allowing us to land our aircraft and stage our aircraft there. They have not yet allowed us to bring people from area over there. The Grand Cayman Islands has offered to let us take off from Haiti, land there with individuals. But right across the border, the Dominican Republic, we continue to run into bureaucratic issues there. It's frustrating. We've had several calls with that government. They do not recognize Florida as an official government. It's got to come through the State Department. I've got a State Department liaison, and I want to thank Joe. I can't remember his last name right now, but Joe is working really hard with us, trying to get those clearances run through the Dominican Republic so we could have a shorter hop and get more people out in a shorter time window. Jamaica is talked about being willing to work with us, but when you get to Jamaica and Cayman Islands, that's a long helicopter ride, and we don't want to put anybody in danger of running potentially out of fuel. So those islands are available, but they're really on the fringe of what we could successfully do. So we're trying to stick to either Turks and Caicos or Dominican Republic, and we are having a little bit of challenges there.
And what are the parameters for, I mean, this is an international flight, although it's relatively close. What are the parameters for paperwork, immigration, identification, and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's again a great question, Glenna. So when a flight happens, number one, we have to have clearance to land at the airport in Cap Haitien. Again, there's some splinter governments there. There is an airport manager. We don't know if he was the airport manager 3 weeks ago or if he was, you know, somebody else. We just don't have any way to verify that. But he is the one that's signing off on our paperwork to land on a day-to-day basis. But on the CBP side of the house, and again, I want to give a shout out to the Orlando-based CBP officers, especially Miguel Ortiz, assistant director here in this region. He has taken every call that I've had. I got connected with him after some bureaucratic issues, and he has been my go-to guy here and his team of helping us get over back to the United States. But when that happens, we have to clear the entire list, the entire manifest. Make sure that there's no B-1 visas, no B-2 visas on there. Everybody has legal right to be inside the United States. And then once we're cleared, we can then operate that flight. So usually as we start to gather people and confirm the manifest list, that takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours to then get it cleared with CBP. You know, obviously we don't want any individuals coming into the country that are illegal or maybe wanted or anything like that. So again, it's a due diligence process and we want to do that. And we want to do it the right way. And again, I think my State Department liaison, and I think Assistant Director Ortiz and his team for everything they're doing to help us out.
It's great to hear that there is that kind of coordination. Director Guthrie, I know you are so busy, and I see the people working behind you in this little emergency operations center. I'm going to ask you to indulge me a couple more minutes. We're going to take a quick break, and
sure.
I want to talk about the larger picture of all that your department is doing when we come right back. are back with Director Kevin Guthrie, the head of Florida's Emergency Management Operations, talking about the flights from rescuing from Haiti Floridians who have been stuck there in gang violence. Director Guthrie, before I want to talk about a little bit of the larger picture of what you're doing as well, but one more question on the actual flights. These are very similar operations. Last October, the state went in and rescued people in Israel, brought them home after the terror attack there. Is there a similarity there between these flights?
There is a similarity, Glenna. The one stark contrast difference is, you know, in Israel, we had a consulate down in Miami that was very engaging with us there, as well as the prime minister in Israel. In this situation in Haiti, there is no government. There is nobody to actually liaise with. So that makes it much more difficult on, you know, dealing with, you know, the governor and I have to do things the right way, the legal way, obviously. But when we're trying to work with a government that doesn't exist, and then we're trying to work with international laws around the area, it certainly is much more difficult. So I would say that in comparison, this particular repatriation has been much more difficult than the one that was in Israel, because we had cooperating governments to help us get back across the Atlantic Ocean.
Have you, or the flights, or anyone, the contractors or the people aboard the flights, have actually had any kind of security scares in the last couple of days?
So I don't know that I haven't got the intel on actual security scares from the actual contractors on the ground, but I will tell you, from the individuals that come back in, they're very thankful to be here. They were living in some very scary situations. This first 35 that we've taken in were more on the periphery than they were actually in Port-au-Prince by the airport, where you see most of the more active violence. So these individuals are scared. They were very scared, but they were also very happy to be home and back to safety. So we were glad to do it. So far, all but three have been Floridians, so 32 out of 35. So we're very thankful to bring Floridians home. And again, we're going to keep working to get them all home. There's over 500 that are trying to get out of country.
On that portal, have signed up on the portal?
Yeah, we've taken in about 700. And on our report this morning, there's over 500, almost 550 that are actual Floridians that have, you know, some type of Florida driver's license, a green card, or a U.S. passport that shows an address here in the state of Florida.
You know, on the State Department flights, I think there have been two so far. They come into Miami International. The State Department is asking the people they're bringing back promise to repay. Is the state doing the same thing?
No, we do not. We're focused on, and this is where the governor just stands very, very tall in the state. He's not going to send you a bill for the rescue efforts that we're doing. You're a Floridian. You pay into taxes in Florida. We're going to come and get you. We're going to get you back home safely. I applaud his leadership. I'm ecstatic that I get to be the one that executes that order. Love the fact that he's taking that line, and we're not going to send a bill to anybody for coming over there and getting them.
Director Guthrie, I want to talk a little bit about you and your department are also in charge of some, and have been for more than a year, but just last week, some extra resources being sent to the Florida Keys in anticipation of what might be a mass exodus, a mass influx of migrants. We actually had the opportunity to fly one of those surveillance flights with the Florida National Guard this week, see a little bit about what they're doing. From your standpoint today, have you any intelligence or evidence that such an exodus might be occurring?
Well, one of the things that Rear Admiral Schofield really wanted us to focus on because of the situation in Haiti, he wanted to be able to push U.S. Coast Guard vessels closer to Haiti to stop individuals from leaving that area. The conditions are very ripe. The risk is very high that individuals could, if further gang violence continued to happen in Port-au-Prince, that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people could exit that area. So he wanted to be able to reposition his the majority of his fleet down there. There are still ships inside the Florida Straits, but he's asked us, and the governor again stepped up and said, we'll be good partners and do what we need to do. And so we're covering the areas from along the Treasure Coast all the way through Miami and down to Key West under the Dry Tortugas with Florida State assets, over 250 Florida State assets. As you can see, and as your camera guys went up in that helicopter, it's a really, really big ocean out there. And it's really hard to see, you know, a chug or a skiff from even 1,000 feet high. as those helicopters fly over the ocean. So we're going to be out there every day looking and trying to detect, but there has been a slight uptick. You saw the situation that happened up in the Treasure Coast with the individuals that were armed with drugs and illegals inside the boat. We did have a landing this week at Duck Key, inside the Keys. So we're seeing some increased activity, but we're really trying to focus on those Florida Straits so the Coast Guard can go down and intercept anybody that comes off the coast of Haiti.
So those, the two incidents that you just mentioned, not only in different places, but I'm thinking the migrants who arrived in Duck Key, I think were Cuban nationals. But just to be clear, as far as Haiti and the gang violence and the absolute terror that's going on there now, we've been reporting that there is really no intel that there has been or a pending mass exodus. And your department, I'm guessing, has not seen that?
Yeah, we're, again, the situation, when we've seen mass exoduses in the past, they've been very similar to what you're seeing right now in Haiti. At some point, there's going to be a breaking point. We hope that breaking point does not come, but if that breaking point comes and it's that, you know, that final straw that breaks the back, then we do anticipate that there's going to be some type of exodus. So again, that's why the membership underneath Rear Admiral Schofield of the U.S. Coast Guard, Homeland Security Task Force Southeast, the governor, the state agencies are all stepping up to make sure that we're prepared for that and we can intervene if we need to intervene when that time comes.
Emergency Management Director Kevin Guthrie, I think I can't thank you enough. I know it has been a really tense time this weekend, and taking the time to be with us this morning, I so appreciate. Very valuable, and good luck to you.
Glenna, great to be with you again. Thank you.
The governor was in Miami Beach this week to sign the law that outlaws living on the street, adds millions to social services for those experiencing homelessness, and also paves the way for counties to create encampments for them with security and rules to stay there. The support and opposition for the bill, now law, had split along party lines in Tallahassee. And in South Florida, there are bipartisan questions and concerns about the costs and the consequence. Ron Book is the longtime chair of Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, personally on the front lines of working to eliminate homelessness and root out its root causes for, oh, more than 25 years? Is that right? You started when you were 12 years old.
I was 12, you've got that right, and it's been three decades.
Wow. Well, that's why I'm really interested to hear your take on this new law. It's very layered. It's been, in our partisan times, it's really been quite controversial. But there, well, you tell me, from your net positive or net negative?
Look, I don't look at it in those terms. And a lot of people think I support encampments. I don't. I don't support any part of encampments. They're not good. They're not going to happen, hopefully, in Miami-Dade or in Broward County.
You don't think they will?
No, because first of all, unlike 65 other counties in the state, Miami-Dade County has had a plan for 33 years mm-hmm. to end homelessness. It started with the Governor's Commission on Homelessness, appointed by Lawton Childs, three co-chairs, Alva Chapman, Jeb Bush, during the period of time between his first race and his second race for governor, and Alex Pinellas. And that became the 10-year plan in homelessness, later the community plan, the 10-year amended plan, then the community plan, and now Project Home. Broward County, 5 years later, made an effort to replicate the plan. They have a different version of the continuum, but both have continuums, and both of them are diametrically opposed to encampments. But in communities where you have no continuum and you have nothing, you've got to balance the interests. And that is all I've said. And this is the beginning of a dialogue. And when you take just the encampment bill and you ignore the fact that they made changes in the legislature, gubernatorial support, DCF support, bipartisan support to pass changes to the Baker Act that were cooked by our own Judge Steve Lifman, the authority on mental health, a member of the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust Board. Yeah. When you take those two together, take the additional $10 million that they put into now a pot of $30 million for challenge grants at the state level for local governments to apply for, and that there is this commitment to broaden and widen this is but a first step in the debate and in the discussion as to the state getting into the program of ending homelessness.
Yeah, and I think you've done a really good job of talking about those layers, because the word encampment is very scary to a lot of people. If you read the now law, if you read mm-hmm. the bill, the word encampment covers a place where there must be facilities, there must be security, there must be a lot of other rules. So it's not just like a big field where anybody can go. So. But to your point, Miami-Dade and Broward were both really concerned. The leaders that we talked to were really concerned about an unfunded mandate, first off, because it's a choice. Counties Correct. Don't have to make an encampment, but there's also that consequence mechanism that allows businesses and residents to sue counties who they don't, or they're challenging for not doing it right. And I think that kind of specter of a lawsuit is pretty daunting for government.
I think it ought to be of concern to everybody. That said, it is intended to encourage, if you will, the building of plans in 67 counties, number one and number two. I think you have to look at the fact that our continuum continues to not only have shelters, but we are building on our inventory of permanent supportive housing. With tremendous support by the Miami-Dade County Board of County Commissioners and Mayor Levine Cava, our effort to create, if you will, using adaptive reuse, acquiring properties and converting them and renovating them into creating permanent supportive housing that the trust will own, the trust will control the units, thus controlling the pricing. That's the way you end homelessness, and it is the only way we will ultimately end homelessness. We have gone from a little over 8,000 unsheltered 33 years ago to now 1,032 unsheltered. We've had a 90% reduction of unsheltered homelessness in our community. We've built a legitimate continuum, and unlike places like San Francisco and Los Angeles, which were similarly situated to us 30 years ago, they got 79,000 unsheltered in LA, where Alberto Carvalho is. He invited me out there 4 months ago. I went to see how bad it was, how bad it is. They're building units of housing for formerly homeless people at the cost of $841,000 a unit. That's not happening here. It's not happening in Miami-Dade, and it's not happening in Broward County that way.
So Homeless Trust, the mission is to end homelessness. Mm-hmm. I was reading the legislative summary. There's more than 30,000 homeless in the state.
Correct.
People here experiencing homelessness, you just put the number at about 1,000. Mm-hmm. Where do you get the money?
Well, the trust has a food and beverage tax that generates significant money
in coastal cities.
It is levied in 32 of our 35 cities, and I include UMSA in that because the county operates as a municipality.
Unincorporated for
municipal
people who don't know what UMSA is.
Unincorporated municipal service area of the county where they provide municipal services to those residents. Miami Beach, Surfside, and Bell Harbor were left out. I lobbied it. I handled it 32 years ago when we passed it.
Left out or opted out?
We exempted them because at the time they were levying some other tourist-related taxes. They didn't want to be at a potential competitive disadvantage to Broward or to, if you will, the ears in Orange County and Orlando. But we told them then that if we ever ran short of money, we were coming back. We went back to the legislature last year. They not only removed the exemption, but they've required us to put a referendum on the ballot in Miami Beach, Surfside, and Bell Harbor, which will happen in November of 24. Miami Beach and Bell Harbor have already, with their leadership, put the issue on the ballot for their citizens to vote on. This tax is not levied in hotels. It's not levied in the tourism-driven areas, but it is in our restaurants, those that gross $400,000 or more and have a liquor license. Here's what I can tell you. It is time to level the playing field so that all 35 of our municipal areas, the restaurants that qualify, are charging it. The revenue we will get by approval by those three cities, I can assure the community, as we've reduced homelessness by 90% over the 30 years, we will finish. We will be the first urban community in the United States of America to end homelessness as we know it today. Does it mean 100% of the people will be off the street? No, we can't legislate mental health, substance abuse, and alcohol. But the tools that we're getting with Baker Act changes and Marchman Act changes coming in the future, resources from the state for, if you will, behavioral health and substance abuse treatment, that will get us there. And more money for housing, conversion housing. We don't have the time, we don't have the money to build. We have to convert buildings, and I'm optimistic that our county commission, our mayor will continue to help get us there. We will end homelessness.
Without encampments.
Without encampments. Don't need them, and we don't want them.
Ron Book, great to have you.
Thank you.
Homeless Trust and so many other things. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, you snooze, you lose, might be the headline on a court opinion this week that tossed a South Florida developer's win to build on fragile lands. But that might not be the end of it, and that is next. A bit of a bombshell ruling late this week, 2 years after a vote to open for development hundreds of environmentally sensitive acres in South Dade that were until then protected. An appeals court said, throw it out and do it over. It wasn't the environment that was the legal issue, and it wasn't the warehouse and logistics center developers planned to put there. It was the delay of vote the commission kept postponing, apparently to give the developer more time to secure enough votes. Miami-Dade Commissioner Danielle Cohen-Higgins is the one on the dais who represents that area, an opponent from the project from the start, and right here with us live. Commissioner, nice to have you.
Good morning, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
So my phone kind of blew up when this opinion came down. It's an opinion from the Second Circuit in Leon County, and essentially says that Miami-Dade County missed deadline.
A critical deadline written into this statute that governs the process that we have to follow when there is a request to make an amendment to what's called our comp plan or our comprehensive development master plan. And here, that critical deadline was October 27, 2022. And mind you, this was the critical deadline by agreement between Miami-Dade County and the developer. The original deadline was April 27. They agreed to an extension. Once that deadline came, October 27, 2022, as you recall, Glenna, because you were covering this story every single step of the way, there were a total of 4 different deferrals that had taken place, and the final vote to adopt these comprehensive development master plan changes didn't take place until November 1st, 5 days after that deadline. And it was the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, which is the agency tasked with reviewing these applications and essentially has that final word, said, no, you missed your own self-imposed deadline. There was an extension, you agreed to it, letters were sent confirming this deadline, and instead it was missed. And so Miami-Dade County argued, no, the statute only requires us to have a public hearing, and that second public hearing took place in May, well within the deadline, and the court opined in a 20-page, very, very detailed opinion just on Friday, a couple of days ago, that no, Miami-Dade County, that May 2022 date wasn't the date for you to just have the public hearing, it was the date for you to adopt any of those changes, which didn't take place until November 1st, 2022. So the timeline is important here, and you're absolutely right, Glenna, when you report the decision is not falling on environmental issues or concerns, nor the developer's arguments as it was presented to the board. We tackled all of those in the 14 months that this application was heard. Rather, the issue turns solely on a procedural issue that the court said.
I'm so impressed that you know every single date off the top of your head. But let me just kind of hammer home for people why this was such a big deal is because for this particular project, the county moved the UDB, moved the urban development boundary that protects sensitive lands. I mean, that is a very big deal move. And without taking sides, whether that was right or wrong, that's why this was such a monumental effort. And there's a coalition of groups, as you know, called Hold the Line, that's that preserves green space and the environment and worked very hard on this to get this through. This opinion doesn't say this project is without merit. This opinion doesn't say it shouldn't go there. So you know, is that really a win aside from, you know, now kicking the can down the road? I mean, this could still happen, no?
You're absolutely right. It is a win in the environmental community, and there were so many in opposition to this application. And you're absolutely right. We had moved the urban development boundary in Miami-Dade County for some 15 years prior, and it was for hundreds of acres of environmentally sensitive land in the South that was being looked at very closely, if not the determination being updated now that it's part of a comprehensive Everglades restoration program. But yes, you're absolutely right that this doesn't mean that the urban development boundary will not be moved on this application. What this court ruled was Miami-Dade County, you missed a deadline, and this statute that it's operating under is self-executing, which means if you miss the deadline, the application is deemed withdrawn, and the votes that were taken on November 1st, 2022 is a null and void vote. Why is this important, and why is this deemed a win by myself, my district, and the environmental community? Because the board of county commissioners is entirely different today than it was on November 1st, 2022. Five of the commissioners that voted in favor of this application no longer sit on the dais. And so this applicant will have to come back before the Board of County Commissioners. Rehearing will be taking place. Public hearing will be opened again. And the community will be mobilized again the way that it was 2 years ago in such a huge way. Commissioners said at the time they had never seen an application with this much opposition before, and for good reason, because of how poorly this application was presented and the many environmental concerns. All of that will likely happen again. It comes back to the board for another vote, according to Judge Marsh in Leon County.
So I want to sort of, because I was there to witness this, I want to lift the curtain for people. The day one of the first couple of delays in the commission chamber, this is kind of the behind the scenes that I really would love you to explain to our viewers. Literally, the vote was about to be taken. It was about to be against the developer. The developer's rep jumped up and ran toward the dais. And before he could even ask for a deferral, the deferral was done. It was lifting the curtain on how things are cooked at the commission. No disrespect intended, but can you just lay bare that does happen?
You know, I am not going to opine on what my colleagues may have done or may have happened at that time. I do remember that hearing and the sequence of events that you just described. And listen, I went on record and said on the microphone on November 1st that this thing is so cooked, it's so cooked that it's burnt. Acknowledging that at that point, after four deferrals, this thing came to our board initially in September of 2021, and a final vote was not taken until November 1st, 2022. After four deferrals and two public hearings, if not three public hearings, that the votes were finally in line for this thing to move forward. And it was a devastating vote for myself and many, not only in the environmental community, but understood that this application was very, very poor for so many reasons.
So what comes next now? Because the logistics and warehouse and logistics center, I think it was called, promising thousands of jobs in an area of the county that really could use thousands of jobs. I mean, I know people have seen a lot of merits to this project. So what happens now? Do you think this will come back in a way that's more palatable for moving that line?
You know, that's a wonderful and an interesting question. The applicants have an option at this point. They can either appeal the decision that was made by Leon County, but again, it's a 20-page decision. I'm an attorney by trade. Reading that decision, I have very little confidence that decision will be overturned, and so they will have to come back before the board. Whether they submit an entirely new application or a replica of what came before us previously, we have yet to see. But I do know that, again, this is hundreds of acres in environmentally sensitive land, critical for our SERP, which is our Everglades Restoration Program. I am going to hope that my colleagues, and these are entirely new colleagues, will see this application for what it is, not get persuaded by the promise of jobs. It's important to note that in the South on 132nd Street, very close to where this line was moved, there's an Amazon warehouse facility that the county granted to Amazon in 2020. They had to provide 325 jobs by September of 2023. Guess what? They haven't secured one job, and there are hundreds of thousands of warehouse square footage sitting right there unoccupied. So the first need in Miami-Dade County, or the first thing that you need to establish in Miami-Dade County in order to move our urban development boundary line, is need. They were not able to establish it in 2022. They certainly can't establish it now. So I don't know what the future will bring, but if it comes back before the board, I and our community will continue to mobilize against moving the urban development boundary in that particular area, which is extremely environmentally sensitive land.
And we will be there to cover it all. Commissioner Danielle Cohen-Higgins, so good to have you on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Until the celestial show in the sky, we've been waiting 7 years to experience a total eclipse of the sun. Will cast an arcing shadow path from the southern border to Niagara Falls. South Florida will see a partial eclipse, though millions in the U.S. will be in that path of totality. And aside from the serious wow factor, the total eclipse is a once-in-a-lifetime chance for scientists to discover things about the sun that they have yet to learn. With us today, the CEO of Frost Museum in Miami, and did you know, lucky for us, Dr. Doug Roberts is an astrophysicist. Dr. Roberts, great to have you.
No, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I think our producers are being funny and just put me in total darkness. Okay. So you will be the first astrophysicist, I think, ever on our program, so I'm very excited about that. So I will say, I went to the total eclipse to cover it in 2017, and it was so cool factor high. But I want to hear from you is what kind of scientific opportunity this one this year, next month, is going to be.
Well, every time that a solar eclipse happens, the moon completely covers the sun for a few minutes. And when that happens, scientists can peer and actually see the sun's atmosphere without being blinded by the light of what's called a photosphere, which is the part of the sun that we see. So when that happens, that chance alignment, we have the ability to explore the sun's atmosphere in ways that we can't, most of the rest of the time when we observe the sun.
How do you do that?
Well, they have different telescopes that essentially look at sort of the fingerprints of the sun, the composition of the gases, how they're moving. And that the sun is a variable object, so it changes. Sometimes it's throwing out a lot of wind, sometimes it's not as much wind, and understanding that helps us understand its effect on the solar system. Actually, the cosmic rays and high energy particles that are expelled from the sun interact with our atmosphere and our magnetic field around our planet to cause the northern lights and potentially damaging satellites and radio communications. So the more we understand about the physics of the sun, the more we can prepare for and make sure that what the spacecraft we have in orbit are safe.
And so you can't do that unless the sun is blocked?
Some observations can be done with spacecraft. They're actually in orbit around the sun, but other observations really need that you to block the light of the photosphere to see, because you said you saw the eclipse in 2017. So if you see it with your eyes, you see, it just looks totally different. And it's that difference that allows you to see that kind of, it's called the sun's corona, that is really impossible to see with the brightness of the photosphere.
You know what I thought was really interesting about this year, NASA and some of the research groups probably that you're talking about are relying on sort of citizen scientists to do some of the research. So they'll be relying on what, like lay people's camera shots or video, and what good will they be looking for there? What good will that do?
Yeah, so there's a citizen science project that NASA did in 2017 eclipse, and they're doing it again this year, where anybody who's observing the eclipse can take photos of it and upload it through a website at NASA, that where NASA scientists will then be able to again look at the eclipse as it moves across the planet. So if NASA were to set up a telescope and observe one location, they would get a great shot from that location, but that only lasts for a few minutes, and then that the shadow passes to another location. So if we can have citizen scientists, which are basically everybody who has a smartphone looking at the eclipse during the moment of totality along the eclipse path, then they can capture all the information to get a better understanding of what the phenomenon is going on.
You know, when we were there, we actually chose Columbia, South Carolina last time. I know you can't see your television, but Darby, our director, has put me in total darkness. He has put me in an eclipse.
Okay.
So when we were there in Columbia, the in the path of totality. Totality was, I think, 2 minutes and some change. And that was certainly enough time to, you know, feel the kind of lavender aura and hear weird bird chirping and for everyone in the field with us to sort of gasp in the glow. But this time, it's going to be a bit different. Totality is actually 4.5 minutes, almost twice. And yes, there are some other changes too. The moon is closer to the Earth. Well, talk about like what's different this time.
Yeah, so basically the moon goes around the Earth in not quite exact circles. So sometimes it's closer to the Earth during an eclipse, and sometimes it's further. Actually, there was an eclipse last October where the sun, where the moon was more distant, and so its angle in the sky didn't quite cover the sun, and that was what was called an annular eclipse. The eclipse this time, the moon is closer, and it's actually closer, as you said, than 2017. So it covers more of it, and also it, as you say, the eclipse lasts longer. So that will allow for one of the cool things that happens during an eclipse. You probably observed was the animals around start reacting to the what looks like twilight or dusk instantly, and so it's a crickets will start cricketing and frogs will start croaking and
frogging
and,
frog yeah, frog
and so they'll that all happens long the longer the eclipse goes on, the more the animals are kind of, and the more you feel that actually the temperature might drop 10 or 15 degrees in 2 or 3 minutes. And so the 4 minute eclipse actually will feel more, and also people go to great lengths to see eclipses, and so you would go there, and so you would pay whatever money you could to extend that for 1 or 2 more minutes. So going to the longer eclipse is definitely worth doing if you have a chance.
We were there then, and that day I started planning for 7 years later, we're going again.
Well, that's what everybody says. I did the same thing. I was there in Missouri, where I saw the eclipse. And as an astronomer, it was the first one I saw in 2017, and that was exactly my thought too, was, when's the next eclipse?
Let's do it again. Listen, Dr. Roberts, real quickly, I know that the Frost Museum is doing a big deal eclipse program. Quickly, tell us about that.
Yeah, so the weekend before the eclipse, again, the eclipse is on Monday, April 8th. It starts around 1:45 in the afternoon until 4:15. During the weekend before, we're going to have a special planetarium show and educational activities talking about the history of eclipse, how to observe it safely. We have these eclipse glasses you can get at the museum, and we'll have solar telescopes to watch it. We'll also have live feeds from NASA showing the eclipse in totality from various locations. And then the Sunday before, we're working with the Alhambra Orchestra and presenting kind of an orchestral performance and art and astronomy art, including some information around the eclipse with some educational activities.
That sounds great. Sky geeks, let the flag fly. Absolutely. Dr. Roberts, great to have you on the program.
Enjoy the eclipse.
Thanks so much.